We're in lesson number 36 in the book of 1 Samuel. We're in chapter number 16 and we're down to verse number 21. And what has just happened previous to verse 21 is Saul has sent word to Jesse to send his son David to come to be his musician. And Jesse loads up a donkey with bread, with a goat, with wine, and sends it off with David. So with the donkey loaded, David approached the camp of Saul. We wish the writer could have told us all that was going through David's mind, but he did not. David had already been anointed to be the next king. He's going to the king. He has to be thinking something. But be that as it may, we come to see Saul's love for David. Then David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. The writer does not tell us that Saul immediately loved David. He doesn't tell us he did immediately. He tells us that David attended to Saul and that he had to have done that for some period of time, and yet it was a short time. And so in that short time, Saul came to love David and to trust David. His musicianship must have hit the spot when the evil spirit troubled Saul, and it pleased Saul with David. But notice that Saul made David his armor bearer, not just his musician. In almost all cases, the armor bearer was the most trusted friend and servant of the noble. The same would be true with David and Saul. Saul trusted David enough to allow David to be closer to him than even some of his children and wives, let alone his generals. As the armor bearer, David basically was Saul's butler, his dresser, his scribe, his food taster, etc. David won Saul's heart, at least when he was in his right mind. But that will certainly change as the story progresses. David won Saul's heart, and that caused Saul's desire for David. What did Saul do then? Verse number 22. Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight." This message to Jesse asked that David be allowed to stand before him. Now, we would say it in a different way now. We would say it, "Let David now remain in my service, for he has found favor in my sight." Why did Saul ask this of Jesse? It was because David was underage. It took the permission of Jesse to allow David to stay permanently with Saul. But an affirmative answer to this request gave benefits to David. He would be entering into the formal education into the life of a king, into the court of a king, and the opportunity to rise in the ranks of the mighty men of valor with the king. Basic training for the next King David. Now, evidently, Jesse said yes because David attended Saul. Verse number 23. So it came about whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. We have all been around people who seem to have an evil spirit coming and going from them, on them, by drugs, legal, illegal. They're just such people like this. Today, people cause the evil to come upon them by their own doings, by the way, with the drugs, with strong drink. But those are not the kind of people we are talking about. As in the case of Saul, the people we are talking about have all sorts of bouts with all sorts of emotional things, and those things manifest into evil moods and characteristics of behavior such as depression, obsession, trepidation, apprehension, dejection, consternation, and more. Now, as we will see, all of these moods and thoughts for Saul were in his personal tribulation. Yet David's harp music erased and calmed Saul's mind. David must have always had his harp within reach when he was around Saul. Now, once again, the writer of this book of 1 Samuel, be it Gad or Nathan, we do not know which, does not tell us how long the period was between David joining Saul as his armor bearer and musician and the appearance of the story of the conqueror of the Philistine giant and the camp of the Philistines. The last time we heard of Saul, he was at Gilgal with Samuel. Samuel left him. More than likely, he was at his home in Gibeah, where David was anointed, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David and left Saul. With the Spirit leaving Saul, an evil spirit was allowed by the Lord to trouble Saul. But now, we find Saul down in the tribal area of Judah, and he is in a standoff with the Philistines and their giant warrior. Chapter number 17, verse number 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and they camped it between Soko and Azekah in Esarhaddon. Saul and his men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side while Israel stood on the mountain on the other, with the valley between them. If you will remember in chapter 5, the Philistines were still in control of Israel after the death of Samson. His death did not end the domination of the Philistines over Israel. His death just slowed the Philistines down when he killed all of the leaders and the lords of the Philistines and their spouses. The Philistines reorganized anew, continuing to exact taxes and goods from Israel until Samuel brought that to an end at Ebenezer, where he placed that stone. We do not think of Samson being a failure as a judge of Israel, but he did fail. He was the only judge chosen by the Lord who failed, unless you want to include Judge Barak, who acquiesced his duties to Deborah. Nevertheless, Deborah was a success. Deborah was the wife of Lapidoth. Now, I want to tell you, some scholars believe that Lapidoth was the nickname for her husband. And guess what her husband's name was? This is what they think. They think her husband's name was Barak, the guy who was the judge. And his nickname was Lapidoth. Lapidoth means woman of torches, or means a fiery woman. It may be possible that Barak had that nickname because of the strength of his wife, Deborah. Some argue that this may be true because Deborah is introduced in the role of a wife, but is not presented in the role of a wife, but rather a fiery woman. Nevertheless, Deborah, or I should say the temperament of a wife, but a fiery woman, nevertheless, Deborah gained the glory of the victory as the scripture promised Barak. Samuel was not a failure. If you will remember, in chapter 4, the Philistines captured the ark at Ebenezer and took it back to their camp, and then back in their tribal area, where it gave them all sorts of fits and illnesses. And they returned that ark to Israel, where it was stored for 20 years. After returning the ark, the Philistines met Israel back in battle at Ebenezer, where they were defeated under the leadership of Samuel. After the victory, Samuel set a stone and said, "So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come any more within the border of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel." The cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron even to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. Now, how do we reconcile the entry in chapter 7 with the entry here in chapter 17? In the entry in chapter 7, the Philistines gave up all their domination in Israel when they were defeated. From the border of the Philistine tribal area of Ekron and Gath, which is on the border, Ekron's on the border, Gath is on the border. This is the Gaza Strip. We know it today, we call it the Gaza Strip. It wasn't called that back then, but we call it that. The five major cities where the five major kings or lords were Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, Ashkelon, and Gaza. Ekron and Gath were right on the eastern border of what we call the Gaza Strip. That was essentially the cities on the border between the Philistines and the Promised Lands, where these cities, they had little villages out here, but it was based, these are the two cities. One note here, the Gaza Strip is essentially the same tribal land that the Philistines have controlled since they moved into the land long after the Canaanites and the Egyptians controlled all of this land. The only loss and gain of land in the Gaza Strip has been when Egypt, not Israel, but when Egypt, Egypt's down here, encroached on their land and then they would take it back, okay? And there's a little stream down here called the Wadi Egypt, and that Wadi Egypt is basically always been the dividing line between the Philistines and the Egyptians, okay, since that time. Now, the Wadi Egypt, which is there, these Philistines, okay, captured this land having come down from Kaftor near Greece. They came from way up near Greece and moved down here. They were sea-going people. They were sea people. They were boaters and all of that. That information would become important when we hear the name Goliath in the following verse. But for now, the important point is that later in time, a Caesar is going to mispronounce the Philistine name and is going to call them Palestinians. That name is going to stick because it's going to go down into the record books as the Caesar called them Palestinians. They are no longer Philistines. They are now Palestinians. Today, Palestinians claim that Israel is on their land, but that is not true. The Palestinians only own the Gaza Strip that Joshua did not take away from them. When the writer says, "So the Philistines were subdued and did not come anymore within the border of Israel," and then tells us that the Philistines restored all the land back to Israel that they were dominating, it is a statement that the Philistines did not come to the land and dominate it any longer or as long as Samuel was alive. Now, surely, the Philistines tried to dominate the land as they will try to do in our current passage. But they will not be successful as long as Samuel is alive, and Samuel is alive. In fact, as we will see, the Philistines did not enter Israel for this battle, for they were camped on their side of the boundary line. It is also interesting that we are told that once the ark was returned, it was stored for 20 years. In 2 Samuel, we are told that at the end of the 20 years, David would move the ark to Jerusalem. Now, backtracking the timeline means that the ark was taken in the 27th year of Saul's reign as king. Yet, he had nothing to do with the battle of Ebenezer, where Samuel led the victory and set the stone, because they're not seeing each other. Why? It was because prior to the capturing of the ark, Samuel had already left Saul at Gilgal for the last time and never saw him again. It is possible, although we are not told, that it was Saul who called for the ark to be brought into the battle of Ebenezer, where it was captured by the Philistines before Samuel got involved later on. Then a little more than 7 months later, Samuel led the charge against the Philistines and ousted them from the land, but Saul was not involved. By that time, David had already been anointed as the next king, and Samuel decided not to record the name of Saul in the battle that he did not attend. Now remember, Samuel's testimony is found in chapters 1 through 7, but neither Gad nor Nathan picked up the pen, either Gad or Nathan picked up the pen in chapter 8 to record Samuel's story. because Samuel's not talking about himself in the first seven chapters. And Nathan and Gad want to talk about, and the Lord wants Samuel talked about. So for now, Samuel is out of the picture. Got it? Where we are right now, we're in the Valley of Elah, and I'm going to show that to you in a minute. Samuel is out of the picture. He's not with Saul, and David is there, going to come. He will not return to the story until chapter 19, verse 18, by the way, when David had to run to him for safety from King Saul. So Saul is alone with his army down in the tribal area of Judah, stationed on one hill with the Philistines stationed across the valley on another hill, and the Philistines are intent on taking Israel back, but Samuel is still alive. So we know they will fail. The Philistines gathered, okay, at Soko, but then camped at Ephes-Danion. Ephes-Danion is a boundary line between the Philistine land that is still yet to be given back. Do you catch that? The Philistines still control land over here, Ekron to Gath and all of that. They are still controlling this land because it has not been given back yet, as has been told to us. So the Philistines come and they gather at Socar right here. All right. And it's right on this boundary line. They are right there. There's a river or creek that comes above Ashdod, comes down above Gath, comes over and around Soko, down past Abdullam. And here is this creek. The Philistines are on the Philistine side of this creek. It's not in the Gaza Strip, but they don't own this land, but they've been controlling this land because it hasn't been given back yet. All right, here's what they do. The Philistines are intent on taking this land back. They want Israel. If you look at a map, you will see that Ascah is in the Philistine area and Soko is in the Judean area. Now, I drew this map just wrong. Okay, here we go. It really goes like this. Because right here is a town or a village area that we know called Ascah. A-Z-E-K-A-H. Right here are the Philistine. Right here is Philistine land. Right here is Judean land. Okay. So, Soka is in the Judean area. Ascah sits in the mountain rise. Soka sits east across the tributary, that creek, that stream that I'm talking about there, on the rise of the Judean side. So the tributary runs almost east to west from and around Soka to the city of Gath, almost east, it comes straight across over here to the city of Gath, and which is one of the major cities in the Philistine area. All of it sits, get this, let me get a color here, some other color, I'll use this brown color. All of this sits, get this, all of this sits in the Valley of Elah. It's all in the Valley of Elah. It's not a small valley. It is a huge valley, okay? This word is called Ephes-Damian. Is the boundary of blood between the two locations. Right here between the two, boom, right there, is called the Valley of Blood. It's in the Valley of Elah. Much blood was spilt there in many battles. Not as much as up at the Jezreel, but much blood was spilt right here. Even today, the nickname is appropriate because much blood is still being spilt in the Palestine conflict with Israel. Many, many Israelites and Palestinians are dying right here in this blood valley right there because it's so close between the two. But it is still the place, and in the conflict in our passage, get this, only the blood of one Philistine is going to die in this blood, but it's going to get that name. It's going to get the name that it is the boundary of the line of the blood that's right there, but only Philistine is blood of one Philistine is going to be spilt that's going to cause that. In the standoff at the boundary of blood, the champion of the Philistines is presented. So even though he's really not in the Gaza Strip, but he's on land control that's going to be given back, it, right here, this champion of the Philistine is presented. His name is Goliath. Our writer goes into great length to describe this man. He starts with Goliath's height. Verse number 4. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. A cubic is the length from the tip of the middle finger of a man all the way to his elbow. The length differs from individual to individual. For instance, if you use my arm as an example, I am 19 and a half inches long. If you use my wife, she's 18 inches. Thus, we come to the problem when we are trying to identify the height of Goliath. Whose cubic arm length are we using to describe how tall Goliath is? Goliath's height included a span. Now, a span is the difference between the thumb and the little finger as far out as you can put it out. All right, put it across. All right, my hand is 9.5 inches across. My wife's is 8 inches. So if we use the measurements of my measurements, Gath is basically 10.5 feet tall. If you use my wife's measurements, Goliath is 9.5 feet tall. Well, what are we making the point here? Goliath is a big and tall man, truly a giant of men. Okay? He's big. But we don't know exactly how big he was. With the length of the cubic being different between individuals, you might say, how in the world was a building built, like such as the temple, built with such accuracy that a hair could not even be inserted between the stones? How is this possible? Well, here's the way that the cubic was set for the building, and I'll just show you how it was. This is the way it happened. The plans were drawn, and a cubic scale was set on the drawing. All the lines on the drawing were based on this cubic line. So on the drawing should be this little bit of cubic line, and this is called 1 cubic, okay? 1 cubic on the drawings. Then when they got to the build site, the superintendent would go somewhere where everybody knew it, and he would put out his arm, and he would measure from his tip of his finger back to his elbow, and he would say, okay, folks, this is going to be 1 cubic. This equals that. And then what would happen is this would become the rule of the build. And what would happen is, I'm just going to use this piece of paper, but pretend it's a stick. Men would come up and they would measure out a stick and cut it to this length. And when they cut it to this length, then if it was a half cubic, they just would half the cubic. Now there's a half cubic. This is a whole cubic. This is a half cubic. When they needed a quarter cubic, they just did it like this. And now they knew exactly where a quarter cubic was. And then they could do it for an eighth and for a 16th or whatever that the plan said to use on the cubic on the plan. So everything would be uniform. Now, many scholars tell us that the Israelites were small people and their cubic may have been more on the average of 17 inches and their span would have been 6 inches. In other words, they were much smaller and shorter people than I am and their hands were much smaller than mine by almost 3.5 inches. Even with those measurements, Goliath, even with a cubic being 17 inches and a span being 6, even with that, it only changed the height of Goliath a little bit. Goliath would, if those measurements still been 9 feet tall. Well, from Goliath's height, we come to Goliath's armor in verse number 5. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with a scale armor which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. All right. First, you might ask how the writer knew how much Goliath's armor weighed. Well, we'll find that out after David killed Goliath. Goliath and the armor were in the possession of Israel so they could weigh it and figure it out. Other translations properly call Goliath's armor a chain armor or a coat of mail. Little circle plates is what it is, of bronze, were wired and linked together to form this bronze cloth that looked like the scales of a fish. Bronze is a heavy metal. A common bronze shekel contained 1/4 ounce of material. If the scales were the size of a bronze shekel that we have discovered, his armor weighed about 78 pounds in what we would call pounds today. Okay? Now, it tells us here that his entire armor and everything weighed 5,000 shekels. Well, 5,000, what do we got? We got 78 pounds. Now, for a man Goliath's size, he could handle that weight. But, however, if it was small little scales, the size of today's nickels, there would have been 5,000 attached. This was illogical to me. I would think that the size of the scales was closer to what we call the half dollars today, of a real shekel. That would have meant that about 5,000 pieces weighing about 10 ounces apiece, that would come up to be sewn together to make the armor. This seems more plausible to me.